All right, so let's just dive right in, starting in verse 11 there. It says, "Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. If you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another?" And we've all heard this before. We know that we're not supposed to speak evil of any of other people in the church, and that it's not okay to tear people down and basically, you know, yell at them or even behind their backs say this person stinks. It's not okay. But we know that it happens in the church. It happens outside of the church, but more importantly, it happens in the church where it shouldn't be happening, and where we should be lifting each other up. We tend to tear each other down. And we speak evil of each other, and we tend to judge each other. And the reason that we tend to judge each other is because of sin. And we look and we see sin, and we're not happy with sin, because, well, we shouldn't be happy with sin. But our response is usually, "I don't like that person," or "this person is doing this." And we often speak behind each other's back. And we judge the brother or the sister in the church, and that's equivalent to judging the law. And the law that James is speaking of is not the law of the Old Testament, it's not the Ten Commandments, but rather the royal law that he's been speaking of throughout James. That we need to be loving others, and that we need to love God as ourselves, or we need to love others as ourselves and love God. Yeah. But how we treat Christians is in a sense how we respect God. Knowing that these are God's children, we cannot be tearing them down. And there's these two options that we're given here. You can be a judge or a doer of the law. You don't get to be both. And one position's already filled. By being a judge of God's word, or of God's people, we are not doers. We are failing to show love, as he asked. We are failing to do exactly what we're condemning others to do. In verse 12, it tells us that there is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. That this one lawgiver, we know it's not some man, it's not some person, but that lawgiver is God. And that there are two options of judgment from him. It's either you're guilty or you're set free. You're either saved or you're going to be destroyed. And graciously, he has given us the option of being saved through Jesus Christ. And sadly, our response to other Christians when we go to judge them isn't, "Oh, he's going to be saved by God." It's, "No, we want to destroy them." And if he's given us salvation, then why should we choose to judge others with destruction and destroy them, in a sense? And this here is a reminder of his mercy and how he's been merciful to us, and how the way that he judged us isn't the way that we're judging others. And then he says, "Who are you to judge another?" Well, firstly, you are not the lawgiver. As it says, there is only one lawgiver, and if one of you is the lawgiver, well, it's not going to work out too well, because we don't know how to judge correctly. But we know that the lawgiver is God, and there is only one, and you are not the one. So if you are judging others, by what authority are you doing it? Because a lot of people, when they start judging others in the church, they say they're doing it by the authority of God, but that's not what he doesn't give you that authority, so you can't just go and judge others. So we can't act as a judge if we don't have the authority to judge. We have to leave it to God. And we often act as though God might need a little help in this area. Which is ridiculous to think that God needs help being a judge. But we often act in that way as though, well, God hasn't got to him yet. Well, I better go take care of this. And that's not what we're supposed to be doing, because we have to understand, hey, God's got this. He is the judge. He is the lawgiver. He's going to take care of this, and we have to leave it in His hands. James is speaking on the arrogance that we have towards others. And he goes from speaking about this arrogance towards others, and he's going to transition into this speaking of arrogance to ourselves. In verse 13 it says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." Now, how often do we make plans based on what we think we can do or what is going to happen? And we often find security in making plans because, well, to know what's going to happen tomorrow is a good thing. We'll be taken care of if we can figure out how to take care of ourselves. But God doesn't want us to plan in a way that's based on what we can do or what we're going to do. And oftentimes when we think we're planning a sure thing, we find out, well, it's actually an unsure thing because there are variables that we can't consider. Well, perhaps you die tomorrow. I mean, that's a big one right there. You don't know when you're going to die. You don't know when Christ is coming back. So if you're going to plan something for 10, 20 years from now, well, it seems kind of foolish to do that. And the situation he brings up here is this idea of taking a year, going somewhere, buying and selling just to make a profit, to make some money, as if they know for that entire year they're gonna end up making money. And sure, you can look and you can say, well, if I do this and I take care of this and if I buy the right things at the right price and sell them at the right price, I'm going to make a profit, and it's going to benefit me. But God doesn't want you to take care of yourself. Because then we start relying on ourselves. On top of the unseen variables that, well, what happens if the market goes up or something like that, and you're not going to make any money, and then you fail, and then you're left on the side. And see, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. A sure thing is not always a sure thing. In other words, we need to stop betting on ourselves. We can make plans, but we have to allow God in our plans. We have to understand that God's going to change our plans most likely. And the only sure bet is on Him, that He's going to take care of you, that you don't have to sit there and constantly plan to take care of yourself. And I think a big thing with that is understanding whose life this is. I mean, if it's your life, you're going to do your best to take care of it. I mean, because that's what you're going to do. I mean, if it's yours. But if you understand that your life is God's, well, then you understand that you can just give it over to Him. You can leave it in His hands and that He's going to take care of you. And He says to us in verse 14, He says, "It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away." He's not saying that our life is meaningless, but maybe perhaps we shouldn't be planning to live forever because we're not given forever. We're given a short period of time and we don't know what that is. So we shouldn't be planning to take care of ourselves forever. And that we need to stop planning and preparing to build this physical wealth saving money. A lot of people want to save money, and saving money is good, and you should have a little bit of money saved for certain instances. But if you're just going to keep building up and you see these rich people that have piles of money that they're not doing anything with and they're planning, but, well, they're going to die before they get to use it or put it to any use. Recently with job hunting, I have tried to make plans for my life. Deborah can tell you about this, how we've looked at, oh, maybe we'll move here and I'll find a job there or here. And I mean, I could have come up with like big plans. They would have all failed, and she knows it. I'm not good at planning. But when it came down to it, I mean, for you, those of you who don't know, I'm actually starting as a pastor of a church in Satansville this week, and it's wonderful. It's a tiny little church, but it's probably not the church that I would have chosen, saying, I want to go there, and I'm going to make a profit by going there, and I'm going to build up some wealth, and I'm going to take care of myself, and I'm going to pay off my loans. Now, if it was my plans, I probably would have said, I need a place where I can pay off my loans. But it's God's plan, and you have to leave it up to Him, and it just so happens that I'm going to the small town in PA, and I know I'm not going to have enough to pay off my loans within 5 years, like what I would like to do and just get rid of that forever, but God's going to take care of it. In verse 15, it says, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. So instead of planning for yourself, just understand that it's up to God whether you live or die. And if He chooses to let you live, He's going to give you more than just sitting on the side doing nothing. If He chooses to let you live, He's going to allow your life to be put to use. In verse 16, it says, but now you boast in your arrogance, all such boasting is evil. Speaking of the boasting of what you think you know, I mean, if you make a plan, you plan on what you think you know, or what you think you understand about what's going to happen. And we know that we don't know the future. None of us can see the future. I don't think so. If you can, well, then we'll talk later. But seriously, we need to be relying on God and not ourselves. We have to understand that God needs to be in control, and if we're in control, then that's an issue. And when we begin saying, well, I've done this, or I am going to do this, and it's all about you, and you're thinking about you, then you're doing it wrong. Are we considering God's role in our lives? About how He's taking care of you, and you say, well, I've done this. Well, maybe you should think, well, maybe you've done that, but it's by the grace of God that He's allowed you to even be alive to do such a thing. In verse 17 it says, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. If you know God's desire for your life, or you happen to get a glimpse of God's plan for your life, and you decide to pursue something else, what you think is going to profit you, well, then you're sinning, because, well, it's not about you. And if you realize that you could be doing something for God's glory, then that's what you have to pursue. In the context here, it's obviously dealing with planning. But in God's planning, we must act on wherever He sets us. Like wherever God has put you, if you see something to do that's going to glorify God, well, then you have to act on that, and you actually have to do that. You can't just sit there and say, well, that might not benefit me. That might not be a profit to me. We have to begin thinking, what's going to profit God? What is going to bless God? Continuing on into chapter 5. It says, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. And the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of the Sabbath. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. He begins this by saying, come now, as he did in the last thing, or the last paragraph, and he's talking to a specific people or a specific group of the people within the church. Understand that James wrote this to the church, so he's obviously talking to some people in the church. And the people that he's talking about, obviously, is the rich people in the church, those that have all this money. He says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you." I mean, it's not a good thing. I mean, if you read that and you were rich, you probably would not want to read the rest of James. You wouldn't want to see what else he had to say. I mean, your miseries are coming upon you. Well, firstly, what are your miseries? And it's likely the result of the miseries that they have put upon others, that they have placed on others. But it wasn't just one thing that was going to come upon them. It was a lot. And he goes on to list some things that they're going to have to deal with. In verses 2 and 3, it says, "Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days." He's saying all that you have, I mean, you're rich, obviously, you have money. All that you have, it's going to rot away. Your money and your possessions. It says that your gold and silver are corroded. And for that to corrode, it takes a little bit of time. It just doesn't happen instantly. Gold and silver just doesn't corrode instantly, but it takes a little bit of time. Which leads me to think that maybe James is getting on the idea of hoarders. People who are hoarding money or things as well. I mean, we've all probably seen those TV shows about hoarders where they have their houses full of junk or full of cats and dogs and it's a mess. And typically when we see these shows, it shows the lower class as being the hoarders, having all this stuff that they don't need, and it's building up and they don't have room for it. They can barely live. But the rich, they're hoarders just as well. It just doesn't look as messy. They're hoarding all that money to themselves and they're not doing anything with it. It's just, they're building up bank accounts. I mean, if you have like $34 million just sitting in your bank account, well, what good is that going to do you? I mean, I don't even know what I would do with that kind of money. They probably don't know what they're doing with it either. But they're just kind of hoarding it to themselves and building it up. And it says it will be a witness against them, and it will eat their flesh like fire. And while they are intending to build up for themselves, and they are thinking about themselves, and it's that selfish thing again, where they're planning for themselves and they're building up for themselves, and it's their security. It's going to be their downfall. It's going to be the reason they fall and they burn. And then he says, "You have heaped up treasures in the last days," which is kind of the wrong time to be building up treasures, because you're not going to have any use for it. And pretty soon they're going to see the waste that they have built, that they have built up. And we all know, we've all heard the expression, you know, it's easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get to heaven. We've all heard that. We know that. And it's probably because, well, if you are rich, you've built up for yourself. And there's the issue here. They're building up for themselves and they're thinking about themselves. They're thinking about, well, I have to have enough for tomorrow and for the next 85 million years of my life. But realistically, you don't have that many years, so maybe you should stop and actually put it to use and put it for God's glory. In verse 4, it says, "Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabbath." He's getting at how the rich have treated the poor. Maybe those that have worked and served for them. And he says the poor are going to testify against the rich. Now, if these issues were issues in the world, I mean, they'd be slight issues as we look around. I mean, the rich, there's obviously a problem there. But when it becomes the rich within the church, that problem seems to multiply because they should be understanding. They should understand that their lives are supposed to glorify God and be focused on God and not focused on themselves. It says the wages that were kept by fraud. I don't know if any of you guys have ever experienced working. I hear about it all the time with people who work in jobs, and they're not making a whole lot of money. And they're always told, hey, you need to work more hours, especially with these fast food places. Well, you got to work more hours. And they get their paycheck, and they may have worked 80 hours a week, and they got paid for 40. And then, that might not be the exact issue that's going on here. But for some reason, these poor are not getting paid, and they have been afflicted. But yet they have cried out to God, and God has heard this. It says that God has heard their cries. And it's wonderful when God hears our cries and when He hears us and He goes to act upon it. It's not wonderful when He says, hey, your enemy has been crying about you and now I'm going to act on it. Because He's speaking to those that are the enemy, those who aren't doing the right. In verse 5 it says, you have lived on earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. Getting back to how they use money for themselves, for pleasure and for luxury. And strangely enough, that's how the world views success today. Are you living luxuriously? Are you fulfilling your pleasures? That's what it's all about. And that's what we're expected to do with our money. It says they fatten their hearts as in a day of slaughter. It's all about worshiping themselves. And this just brings this picture to my head about this feast that they're having. They're getting everything ready and they're taking care of things. And they have this big, huge feast with this fattened calf. But the feast is just for themselves. It's just to honor themselves. It's all about the worship of self. In verse 6 it says, you have condemned, you have murdered the just, he does not resist you. When it's not about building themselves up, it's about hurting others. And how the rich hurt others. For money or for physical desire. It says that they have condemned. That they have been tearing down others. That they are blaming others. Thinking that they're better. And then he says that they have murdered the just. And as I read that, I can't help but think about Jesus. And he might just be talking about those that are trying to be just. But I think there's an obvious connection here that he's making with Judas and how his pursuit of money and how he basically murdered Christ and handed Christ over. We just turn for a second to Matthew 26. You guys don't have to turn. I'm just going to read one verse real quick as soon as I find it. It says, then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. So from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. I can't help but thinking that he's saying that the rich are just like Judas. And if being compared to Judas is not a good thing, they knew who Judas was. They were members of the church. They understood this. And when they heard this, I'm sure it just struck them real hard. That in the sense that they have betrayed God because they're seeking to build themselves up. And he says that he does not resist you. speaking of the just, and speaking most likely of Jesus and how he did not resist. Now understand that as we have read through this in James, and how he talks about wealth and the issues that were dealt with then, and about planning, it's okay to have a little bit of money. It's okay to have a little bit of savings. I mean, James doesn't mention anything good to be done with wealth here. And maybe that was for fear of giving them an excuse. Because how often do we take the excuses as we can? He didn't want them to excuse their sin simply by saying, well, you can put it to good use. You can do good deeds with your money. That's not what he wanted from them. He wanted them to understand what they had been doing. And saving money isn't awful, but we have to ask ourselves, is our security in the money that we're saving, or is it in God? Because if your security is in the money that you've been saving up, well then, your security can't be in God. You're not relying on Him. And there are three things that I want you guys to take away from this. Firstly, that we need to love others, that we have to stop degrading our brothers and sisters. Secondly, that we have to stop lifting ourselves up. It's not just stop pushing others down, but stop building yourself up. And stop planning for personal gain. And thirdly, that we have to stop depending on the money and building this essentially a money blanket, this security blanket out of money, because there's a fire coming and that blanket's not going to help you. Ultimately, we need to rely on God. We have to rely upon His Lordship, His judgment, and His plans for our life and His provision. We have to understand simply enough that this life is not about us. It is not our lives to plan for and to take care of. We have to give it over to Him because it's His life, and we have to let Him do with it what He wants.